So our next presenter is Dr. Wes Kennemore. Dr. Kennemore is a manager of health information technology with APHL, where he oversees the laboratory technology implementation assistance for public health, LTAF program. LTAF is a CDC ARA high-tech grant to support ELC grantees in the implementation of electronic laboratory reporting to public health and electronic test order and report between hospitals and public health. As a consultant, he also works with physicians and other eligible providers to develop, implement, and support technology and processes to achieve and maintain meaningful use. Wes.
So I am the last speaker of the day. I'll try to keep this as painless as possible. I don't live in Omaha, so I can't take John up on his steak offer. I'm going to have to maybe remedy that. But yeah, I have to come in and visit. So we're going to take a couple of minutes and take a little bit of a step back and talk about one of the primary drivers of a lot of the electronic messaging and electronic reporting that we're trying to engage in at this point. And obviously that is meaningful use. So we're going to talk a little bit about meaningful use and what it means to public health and how it helps us in driving some of our electronic reporting forward. Here's a few of the topics we're going to cover. I won't belabor those points. You'll see them as we go through the presentation. And basically, at the end of the day, Congress stipulated three primary areas of meaningful use. So the first is that they required us to use an electronic, certified electronic health record. That's really a little bit of a misnomer. They really required that we use a certified electronic methodology. We do have to connect those health records in such a way that we are meaningfully exchanging data, and then ultimately the individual provider needs to be able to report clinical quality measures. This is no surprise to any of you. You've all been around this block a few times. You've seen this. So when I first got introduced to meaningful use, it was more from the clinician provider side. And the first thing I saw was one of these large slides that said, here's all the wonderful things that happen under the ARA high-tech rules. Now, this was a little bit challenging for some of us to try to decipher, so I went to one of my wonderful folks at CDC, and I said, Mary Lurchin, can you please take this and digest it into something that's simple enough that those of us who went to public school in Alabama can actually understand it? So Mary took a step back and said, okay, Wes, this is use. This is meaningful use, okay? And the bottom line is that meaningful use is really not about let's go put in some razzle-dazzle new electronic technology. Meaningful use is about how do we adjust our processes, how do we adjust our techniques, and how do we use that technology in a way that meaningfully allows us to exchange real information about the health of our patients and about the health of our populations as a whole. That's what meaningful use is really all about. You all know that meaningful use is coming at us, and it's coming at us in three stages. The rules for stage one have been out there for a while. We're all working in that environment at this point. We're looking at stage two, trying to decide what's going to be in stage two, and we know that there's a stage three out there on the horizon. And again, this is three paragraphs, a lot of verbiage, and so now I went to one of the consultants on my team and said, once again, how do people who went to public school in Alabama understand these stages? And Srinath said, it's real easy, Wes. Stage one, we're going to look at data capture. Stage two, we're going to look at data aggregation. And then in stage three, we're going to talk about how do we use that aggregated data to have a meaningful impact on what we're doing in our clinical environments and what we're doing in our public health environments to affect the health care of our populations. And I thought this was a very simple and straightforward way to present the data, and I thought it certainly made most of these stages more meaningful to me. And I will learn to speak English sometime before this presentation is over. If you really look at it, meaningful use has five overarching priorities. Again, I think you've all probably read these many times, you've probably seen these many times. But basically, we're trying to improve the quality and safety of healthcare. We're trying to engage patients and families in their healthcare. And for those of you that have attended any of the ONC regional meetings, you've had the opportunity to hear e-patient Dave speak. And he does an excellent job of talking about how to engage the patient in their own healthcare. And of course, that is one of our national priorities. We want to talk about how do we improve care coordination? How often do we look at the difference between seeing a primary care physician and going to see a specialist, and how many times does the test or the procedure get duplicated simply because our clinicians are not adequately coordinating care amongst them. Even in an inpatient environment, we see these same types of things happening. One of our priorities, obviously, is to ensure the privacy and security. That goes without saying, particularly with HIPAA, and to improve our population health as a whole. To drive these priorities, meaningful use, stage one, stipulated a required core set of objectives. We'll talk just a little bit more about those in a minute. Then they also stipulated a menu set of objectives. So really what this says is if you happen to be a hospital, you have 14 things that you must do in order to qualify for meaningful use in stage one. If you're a non-hospital eligible provider, there are 15 very specific things that you have to do. It is interesting to note that the public health initiatives are not actually part of the core menu set. So then the question becomes, how do we drive providers to help us support us in our endeavors in public health? And the answer is that there's a menu set of 10 requirements, and you have to choose 5 of those to implement, but at least one of those 5 must be a public health requirement or a public health initiative. And that's how we're trying to help drive physicians and eligible providers to assist us in our endeavors to improve public health. There's a statement there about suggesting moving all of the public health criteria into stage two. You've all heard that that's been suggested, then that's been de-suggested, then it's been suggested. We really don't know exactly where that's going to shake out yet, but we all know that those objectives are out there. As I discussed earlier, also we need to be able, from the clinical environment, to be able to report on various clinical quality measures, such as the diabetic's A1C, such as other things like this, hypertension management, how often, what is our blood pressure checked and how well controlled, these sorts of things are all things that we have to be able to report on in order to demonstrate that we are meaningful users of technology. I won't go through the other two, but there are just a number of issues out there as we move forward. So how does this all relate to health information exchange? Well, a lot of the interoperability issues are kind of deferred to stage two, meaning that we do have some requirements in stage one, but the anticipation is as we move into stage two that our requirements around interoperability are going to become more prevalent and probably more stringent, and certainly there's going to be a lot more work to do as we move into stage two. A lot of our meaningful use measures are relying on the HIE have been moved to the menu set. And I think everybody can pretty much draw the conclusion or understand that the reason is that the HIEs are very much a larger undertaking than some of our other initiatives. And they're simply taking a little bit of time to get their approaches down and to get on board and to get ready to be active participants in healthcare electronic records exchange as we would like them to be. There are some, you know, we're reducing some of our thresholds in the public health way, public health initiatives. And it's interesting that some of our meaningful use objectives don't actually align very well with some of the other high-tech objectives that have been out there. And I just kind of talked a little bit about the difference between the way the HIEs have been motivated to proceed and some of our other things that we're having to do in stage one, that they don't necessarily line up very well in terms of timing and even objectives. So one of the things that has happened to the HIEs, though, is recently we've come to understand that there are circumstances under which an HIE might have to be certified as a certified technology in order to facilitate electronic data exchange. And this slide is actually one that I liberated from one of my good friends at CDC. And it basically talks about the 3 scenarios under which we might accomplish electronic data exchange or even electronic laboratory reporting. So scenario number 1 is what we actually anticipated was going to happen. We basically expected that the hospital, the provider, would have a certified electronic medical record, that the information from the lab would be integrated into that medical record, and that all the reporting would be done out of that medical record. And I think that was the original intent and the original anticipation of how we were going to proceed down this path. Well, lo and behold, what we discovered is oftentimes laboratories need to report information independent of a clinician's medical record, whether that's in the hospital or a private practice, doesn't matter. The hospital lab, the public health lab, other folks might need to report independent of a health of an electronic medical record or a health record. So we might have a LIMS system that now gets certified as a certified technology, and that LIMS system might now communicate those laboratory reports to our agencies in a meaningful use compliant way. Unfortunately, that's not always possible either. So what we now run up against is that scenario three is where the HIE might actually be receiving data from an uncertified technology, or might be receiving data, even if it comes from a certified technology, that particular message structure might not be compliant, and the HIE might need to transform or perform some transformation services so that they make that message meaningful use compliant. In that case, what we are now coming to understand is the HIE is actually going to have to become certified as a certified technology. Now, there are a number of ways that one can go about that, but one of the interesting concepts that we've discussed, and I actually talked about it with our friends from Rhapsody this morning, as a matter of fact, is that Rhapsody does have a component that is a certified technology. They're not the only integration engine. They just happen to be the one that I talked to this morning. And what they've told us is that those of you that are on support from the CDC license for Rhapsody can upgrade to the meaningful use compliant version virtually free as far as software cost goes. There may be some technical implementation that you need to do, but the bottom line is you don't have to pay an additional fee to get the software provided you're on current support. So that is one thing that might ease the burden in some of the cases of the HIEs. And I'm not sure that message has been well communicated to the HIE community as of this time. But we're going to work on that. So, what are the three public health objectives that we're talking about? Number one is the capability to submit an electronic data to immunization registries. The second one is the capability to provide an electronic syndromic surveillance data to the public health agency. And then finally is the capability to provide electronic submission of reportable lab results. This particular requirement or this particular option is only available to the hospital community, not to the eligible provider community. One of the interesting things here, let's look a little bit more at what we mean by reportable lab results. So it's the capability to submit data on reportable, and reportable as defined by your state or your local jurisdiction, lab results to the public health with actual submission in accordance with applicable law and practice. What that means, it's a big mouthful to basically say, every jurisdiction has its own rules regarding frequency of notification, regarding which particular agents or syndromes might be reportable. And rather than dictating at the federal level a set of requirements that says you must report in this manner, what basically we're saying is you must be able to report to your agency in a manner consistent with your local jurisdictional law. And that's basically what we're saying there. And it's interesting that if you look at the measure, the way that we measure whether or not you've been able to meet that requirement is that basically you send a test message, and here's where it hits us in the public health community, or at least at one point. If we are able to receive that message, then that hospital or that provider, mainly in this case the hospital, has to move that into production, and they have to begin reporting those results on a regular basis. However, if that hospital sends us a test message and for whatever reason we in public health are not capable of receiving that message and dealing with that message, they don't have to try again for another year. They get their public health check boxes. Dr. Foley would say they get their merit badge and they get to go move on and collect their federal money, and they don't have to make another effort to send us a message for another year. So that basically means that it's incumbent and important upon us in public health to be ready to process these messages that the hospitals are going to be sending us. So you look really at reportable lab results, and what are we really talking about? We're talking about a couple of data flows. And basically you'll notice that there's two light gray boxes. One of them is from the hospital to the public health agency. And then there's a little bit darker gray at the top that probably isn't showing real well. It's the public health lab. So the reportable lab results messaging that we're talking about is from the public health lab to the public health agency or from the hospital to the public health agency. And those are the two data flows that we're really talking about at this time. Now, remember, I said that there are no direct regulatory implications on the public health lab. Then there are not. The public health lab is not required to submit messages in a meaningful use compliant methodology. But there's a couple of things that that concern me here, and a couple of things that I think we need to be aware of as the public health community. First is, if we are not able to support meaningful use as the public health laboratory community, if we are not able to support meaningful use compliant messages, and the commercial community is able, the hospitals and the other national labs, and they are able to support those initiatives, basically what's going to happen is we're going to continue to lose our influence in this environment. So we're going to find that we are no longer able to influence policy at the level that we probably need to continue to influence policy. So that's one of the very important issues here that we need to stay aware of. And again, I see this a lot. I travel around. I talk to a lot of laboratories. In addition, not just laboratories, I also talk to a lot of agencies. And I also talk to a lot of eligible providers, and I talk to a lot of the representatives of some of the medical laboratories. And this is one of the things they tell us a lot. They say that we have commercial systems that have been in place for quite a while. We do it very well. Sometimes we don't see the need or the reason. There's no economic motivation in some cases to support these new meaningful use compliant data flows. So, you know, we're not sure that we need to do what you want us to do. And that's going to continue to decrease if we don't step up and support the meaningful use compliance as well. So just one of the things that I think we need to be quite aware of. I do want to point out that we do have a number of opportunities for assistance. As John pointed out, we at APHL have received a grant called the Laboratory Technical Implementation Assistance for Public Health. While we are technically required to support 10 specific ELC grantees, we do have a number of work groups that we're allowing a number of other folks to participate in. We would encourage any participation from any of the public health labs or even public health agencies. We've done a number of interesting things, like establishing some profiles, some standardized profiles, further constraining some of the 2.51 profiles to specifically support public health. So these are some of the things that we're doing in the LTAF program, and there are some additional discussions about potentially expanding that program to be able to support additional jurisdictions. So I'm just putting it out there that feel free to contact me, or most of you probably know other people at APHL better than you know me. Michelle's grinning, so she'll point you my way if you reach out and tap her and say, I want some information about that. I'd be happy to do that. And then, of course, we also, many of us attended a reception last night from the Laboratory Interoperability Cooperative. They are also providing a lot of assistance in this area. So what can we in the public health laboratory and public health agency community do to maintain our influence over meaningful use, maintain our influence in this environment, and be able to support the furtherment of public health initiatives and public health in general moving forward? One of those is we really need to do a review of all of our current and future, we need to review all of our business processes and see how they align with the initiatives that are coming out from ONC, some of the guidelines that are coming out even from CDC, and from a number of the work groups. I think most everybody in here is in at least one and probably four or five different work groups that are going on right now. So we really need to make sure that we're reviewing and staying abreast of all of those and looking at how we can integrate those recommendations into our current processes and in our labs. We need to be very aware of the technologies. This is probably, in my book, one of the most difficult things to do, is to stay aware and abreast of the technologies, simply because there are so many initiatives going on right now. I know I'm directly charged with one of these initiatives, and it's a major chore for me just to try to stay up to date on all the things that are going on with the other initiatives around me, even in some cases other initiatives inside APHL, just because we're moving so quickly and we're doing so much so fast. But this is something that we've got to pay a lot of attention to. We've got to make an effort to try to stay abreast of the technologies. I would encourage each of our agencies, our public health agencies, to actively go out and look at establishing partnerships with hospitals in your area. Those hospitals are, in many cases, already doing electronic laboratory exchange with various laboratories, particularly some of the national laboratories, and they can be a great resource for working together to try to establish some of these requirements and some of these support mechanisms going forward. So I would really encourage you to try to reach out and establish partnerships with some of the local hospitals. And then again, I think our public health labs, our public health agencies, the public health community needs to continue to work to develop further collaboration. I know a lot of times that in the past that has sometimes been a little bit difficult to do, but right now there are so many work groups out there. There's lots of opportunities to be involved, and we need to actively pursue collaboration amongst our different organizations. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about architecture. Dave did a pretty good job of that. And just basically saying that in our LTAF program, we have developed some architecture recommendations as well. These are things that are available to anybody who wants them. We share selflessly and steal shamelessly, I think is what our ONC friends are always telling us. So let's look at the future. Right now we're talking about public health and we're talking about electronic laboratory reporting. But the thing that's coming down the pike next is electronic test order and result. And again, a number of our hospitals are already doing this with a number of the large commercial labs. We're going to be seeing that going back and forth between the PHLs and the hospitals as we move forward. And there are some standards for working through that. So let's look a little bit at a real-world example. What does supplying meaningful use and supporting meaningful use do for us? Now, I'd love to take credit for this particular example, but again, it's something that I liberated from one of our friends in the Meaningful Use Boot Camp. I went to it back in May, and I think some of you might have seen an example similar to this earlier this week. But the bottom line is, let's look at a hepatitis A case and a food handler. So as we basically look through this, what we're finding out is that there are basically a 7-day incubation period. When the food handler starts to experience symptoms, they go to their physician, they get a test, that test gets sent off manually, the paperwork gets sent off manually, the paperwork gets returned manually. Yeah, it may get faxed, but in a lot of times it gets dropped in the mail. And the bottom line is that we could be looking out here to, you know, day 30 or so in some cases before we're actually able to close down that restaurant, and who knows how many cases we could have of hepatitis A spreading before we're, you know, ready to do with that. If we start stepping through this and we look at what happens in the case of a properly implemented, meaningful use, compliant electronic health record, what we find is that we can basically speed up that process by as much as 10 days in some cases. So, but usually around 6 to 7 days, we can increase the speed at which we're getting the reports back, we're processing that information, and we're dealing with the restaurant. You know, and in many cases, a great example here is, let's say we have a restaurant that has a number of individuals that are an individual that has hepatitis A. Well, first thing is that individual now is got to be taken out, but then the other folks that have been exposed now have to be immunized, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if we have properly implemented electronic medical records, meaningful use compliance, the health department might very well be able to go in and look at those health records on those employees and discover that 30, 40% of them may already have been immunized, and they don't need to be immunized again, number one. And number two, it could speed the process of reopening that restaurant and getting those folks back to work, which of course is quite important. So those are just some of the things that we can do, just kind of a real brief overview of a real life example. We could probably spend 2 hours talking about that, but neither you nor I really want to do that. So let's talk a little bit about just our conclusions real quickly. Basically, through meaningful use, we're going to be able to respond much faster and much more effectively to public health events. This response is going to help us, the population as a whole, both in terms of reducing unnecessary immunizations, reducing overall cost, but also just being able to improve public health as a whole, our population health. And the bottom line is, we're going to minimize unnecessary treatment, we're going to stimulate the economy, we're going to be able to do our jobs in public health, leading to a healthier population as a whole. So that concludes my portion of the talk. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, guys. So we do have some good time for questions. I'm going to come out here and play Phil Donahue. This crowd doesn't remember Phil Donahue. So if you have a question, raise your hand and I will come to you. We have a shy group. So I'm gonna pose a question to the guys. Wes and Dave, you both put up architectural slides. And one of the things, Dave, in yours was that there's a lot of different ways to do it, a lot of different architectures. Can you talk about maybe some best practices that you've seen that have worked quite well? Not best architectures, but best practices for architecture.
Can everybody hear me? Probably the best practices are that we need to set expectations early and let the lab and IT know this is really what we're striving to do, so that when we're working with them, they're not pointing fingers at each other to say, well, I didn't know that. I thought you were going to do that. And so, you know, it's all about communication right at the very start, pretty much setting expectations and getting everybody to communicate.
That's good. Everyone wants to get out. I'm going to try to articulate a question knowing that I'm being recorded here. But in my observation, it's been somewhat ironic that the early adopters, especially for the state public health labs, who, Wes, you said there's no direct stipulation on for meaningful use, which actually means there's no direct reward for meaningful use. There are some ELC grants, but from an ONC perspective. But anyway, so some of the early adopters who went and implemented a 2-3-1 message, I don't know if you would say they're being penalized, but, you know, in some way I've heard the feedback of why upgrade to the 2-5-1? There's not a business reason for me to do that, and it does cost me time and it does cost me money. And I'm just wondering two things. Have you heard that feedback, yes or no? And then are there things that we could do to kind of really help ease their pain, if you will?
Yes, that feedback is something that we deal with on a daily basis, sometimes several times a day, sometimes hourly, in fact. And I can certainly understand the thought process, because a lot of folks do feel like maybe they're being penalized for being early adopters. But at the end of the day, we're going to continue to upgrade these message structures anyway. So there is some motivation to do that. But to the point of, and again, to the point of, that since we're supporting meaningful use, that is what meaningful use requires, we do need to do that in order to continue to be supportive. Secondly, from the tool perspective and the things that we can do to kind of help, the answer to that is yes. There are a number of initiatives out there that are being funded by various agencies to help develop upgrade and downgrade tools. Some of those to help upgrade from the 2.3 message to a 2.5 message. Using, for instance, a Rhapsody integration tool. I think there's a process out there for that. I know there's initiative about to try to develop a MIRTH tool to do the same thing, to upgrade the 2.3 message to a 2.5 on the sender side, and likewise to be able for the agency on the receiver side to take that message, downgrade it to 2.3, and then consume it into the NED system or whatever. So, yes, there are a number of initiatives out there to do that.
I noted that you earlier mentioned that there are some architectural recommendations that you have, and I'm going to go look for that pamphlet. I'm wondering if APHL has looked at a solution for transformation. You mentioned the Rhapsody tool, a comprehensive solution, so that no matter whatever messaging formats folks are using, they could plug into this box that will do the transformations that will feed it to CDC and others in the form that it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. You guys want to handle that? I'll take the first stab at it, and then these guys will tell me where I'm wrong, which may be everywhere. We have actually considered a number of these types of things. We've taken a look at how do you do a universal box, so to speak. The main problem with that today is the concept of trying to support it for the long term. So that's the big issue out there that kind of keeps the one universal plug-and-play box. It's not the only thing. Obviously, there are technical limitations to overcome as well. But thinking about how we support that over the long haul is a major issue. And frankly, nobody's been able to solve that. Nobody's been able to answer that question, at least not to my satisfaction at this point. So I think that's a major problem. And then again, just the concept of if you look at how many moving pieces there are today, how do we corral or herd all these cats into one area where we can develop the one box? Now, I have a personal opinion, and this is Wes Kenmore's opinion, and it's worth exactly what you paid for it, which is nothing. But I think that we're probably headed that way. Before I came into medicine, before I came into public health, I was in the commercial IT environment for a number of years. And it's one of the things we did was develop some standard technologies that you could, maybe not one plug-and-play box, so to speak, but at least one technology that supported multiple different methods of interface. Maybe not everything, but 85-90%. And we did that a lot in the commercial world. And I think at some point we are going to get there. I think we're going to get there. We're going to start heading that way very quickly. But right now, I don't think I see a way to get there. No, Sarah, you don't get to ask questions.
I picked on her. She's going to pick on us.
I'm Sarah Imholt from the Arizona Department of Health Services. And I have a question. You've got experience working with public health agencies for some of these data exchanges. What advice do you have for state and local health departments working with hospitals for doing, essentially the same things that you did with us? What advice do you have for us with them, knowing that, of course, we have limited resources and can't send a four-person team out there for a week?
I'll take a shot at this one. I guess somebody alluded to it, maybe Wes, that a lot of hospitals are already there and being able to exchange. They're the producers of data also, so they have maybe a viable business case for already exchanging with large reference labs and things like that. Advice, I guess, would be. Try to look like a large reference lab. They're going to understand that language, and it's going to be pretty innocuous. Seem pretty innocuous to them to just do another interface, another exchange. If they see you as a sender and a receiver, and they know that language.
All right, so these guys not only gave great presentations, but they got you out early. Let's give them a hand.